The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the award-winning website creation platform that helps you make the front page. With Getty image integration and elegant templates, you can give your viewers the whole picture. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, it's a question that's fascinated us for centuries. What is the nature of creativity? Can we find its roots in the human brain? And if so, can we boost our creative powers? We look at the latest research. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Where would we be without creativity? It was creative leaps that shaped our progress from the hand axe in the Stone Age to the internet of modern times. But how do we achieve these novel, useful and often surprising acts? What does the creative brain look like? To discuss the brain and creativity, I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Caroline de Bernardi-Luft from the Department of Psychology at Goldsmiths, University of London. Down the line, we have Dr. Anna Abraham from the School of Social, Psychological and Communication Sciences at Leeds Beckett University. And from the University of New Mexico, we have Professor Rex Jung. Welcome, everyone. Before we do anything else, let's nail what we're talking about when we talk about creativity. Rex, can I come to you first? What is it?
Well, the standard definition of creativity is the production of something novel, useful, and often surprising. So I think that's the best definition that we have at the current point, this interplay of something novel and useful as created by the human brain.
And can I ask Anna, do you agree with that? Caroline, do you agree with that? Anna, maybe you could go first.
Yes, I'm quite uncontroversial in the field, especially of cognitive and brain research. To define it that way, that would be the easiest way. And also the most comprehensive definition we have, and it's existed since the 50s, and it's the one that's the widest in use.
So Caroline, you're on board with this as well. So we know what we're talking about, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so and should we be letting our listeners know about different types of creativity, or should we consider this a process or a procedure or something that underlies creativity in art, science, maths, whatever realm it is sort of manifest in?
I think that creativity is something that goes across all of these different disciplines. It's probably something that the human brain does that can be applied to each of these different disciplines, these domains, in individual ways, pulling in different domains of knowledge, but that the creative process is likely to be very similar across these different domains.
Okay. There's a lot of pretty flaky stuff written and talked about creativity. And I wonder, before we get into the real depths of our discussion, can we do a bit of myth busting? First of all, is creativity about being a genius? Do we need to be geniuses to be creative?
Not really. I think I'll just continue from what Rex said earlier about creativity being an ability that goes across domains. If you think about it in, like you would memory or attention, it is. We have this capacity, all of us do, some of us better than others, just as some people have better memories than other people do. So equating creativity with genius only is really one of the biggest misnomers out there. It's actually not very good for the field to try and understand the creative brain at all.
And what about this idea of it being a right brain, left brain type thing, that there is a creative hemisphere? Is that another thing that our listeners can just put to bed?
I think it takes a lot, if not all, of your brain to be creative. It is not localized in any one place of the brain, and it certainly is not localized in the right hemisphere of the brain. This comes from studies that were done in the 60s and 70s with split brain patients. Sperry and Gazzaniga were doing surgeries to help prevent epileptic seizures from being transmitted from one hemisphere to the other. And they found that the two hemispheres functioned in very different ways. And this got taken up by the popular press, which often happens like wildfire, nonverbal artistic types of activities were localized somehow in the right hemisphere, but certainly very important processes in the left hemisphere, the frontal lobes, the right hemisphere throughout the brain are involved in creative processes.
And the final one, I mean, there may be more myths, but one I definitely wanted to bring up was this idea that plays off the sort of romantic notion of the mad genius. I mean, we had this in the press, and I'm sure the press are often culprits in all of this, where a prominent paper came out, I think, in Nature Genetics from the Decode team in Iceland, where they were looking at genetic overlap between populations that were allegedly creative and populations that had brain disorders. Is there anything in that idea of madness and creativity overlap? Anna, you've written about this recently.
Yes. It depends on what you mean by overlap, really. It's sort of a very stable idea that has existed for a long time, and the question is why. There's a lot of, as you know, anecdotal evidence out there that equates high degrees of creativity in populations that are associated with mental illness. So that's been largely driving this, some would say myth, some would say there's something there. But I think that's also the human sort of penchant for seeing causations where there might just be relations. So for instance, creativity is associated with the tolerance for a great deal of ambiguity, and so is mental illness. So there are certain characteristics that seem to be there in people who are highly creative as well as people who suffer from certain forms of mental illness. And then I think there is this very strong tendency to then see both as the same thing or very strongly related to one another.
What do you make of it, Rex, this idea?
I agree completely with it, with what Anna says. I would say, first of all, that no artist or creative person has done their best creative work in the throes of mental illness, whether it be schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression. It's usually, in some of the iconic examples, it's between the psychotic episode or the depressive event that the creative work is done. So there is some interesting overlap, as Anna says, about the mental organization or the brain organization in these individuals, but to equate mental illness with creative capacity is quite an overshoot of both of these, and a simplification of both mental illness and what it takes to be creative.
Caroline, you're at Goldsmiths, where there are an awful lot of artistic people. It's a very artistic college or university. Do you see any of this in your day-to-day life? Are there artistic people there who you see that seem to have more mental illness than others, or does it come up as an issue?
Well, what I see here is that this link between creativity and madness is highly well-known between artists. And actually, it became sort of culture that they actually think, so, like, it's very common to talk to them, and some people actually think they must have something, or they don't want to take medication because they think they'll take their creativity away, which is also related to how we define creativity, I think, as we started. Because people tend to think of creativity as the big geniuses and artists, and especially think of certain creative occupations as more creative. So we have a high availability bias that we always remember the artist that had some mental illness, but it's not really something that is supported statistically if you consider that mental illnesses are really prevalent in the population, and that doesn't mean that it's more creative people there than elsewhere. However, some studies have shown that people in more creative occupations, they tend to have higher incidence of mental illnesses, which is not exactly true, because looking for these professions doesn't really mean you're more or less creative. That's a wrong link. So in my view, this link is not really supported. But if we define creativity as the big C, the big geniuses, and the real life sort of focus on like these exceptional people, it might be some correlations between, because creativity, if we define that as the small C, as the everyday problem solving, thinking out of the box concept of creativity, then because it involves so many cognitive processes, it might be reasonable to think that some traits present in certain diseases or certain mental disorders, they might be well correlated with certain cognitive processes, because we don't have one, like we have one brain, so we are likely to use the same areas or like overlap in brain circuits that would kind of fundamentally be involved in both. So that's my view. I think it's a no for creativity and the madness as a mental illness, as a clinical disorder, and a might for correlations between certain creativity skills or certain creativity processes and certain traits.
But this idea of the tortured artist is such a strong one that you even see it in artists in your university, where people with, as you say, depression, maybe other conditions, will not want to take medication because they feel it may affect their creativity. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. So I always think about the ethical implications of this, because there is a widespread notion between many people, especially like the people I have more contact with, that actually think that the mental illness is important for their creative process. And many of them would prefer to go through the disease or to feel dysfunctional or to be dysfunctional rather than taking the medication, because they think, they believe this would help. And I think that's a danger.
Rex, do you think science, or maybe particularly neuroscience, does have the power to try and pick apart what creativity is? Is it not a misguided thing to even look for sort of neural correlates of creativity, for example?
Neuroscience is a tool, and it's one of many tools that we have to look at how creativity is manifested in the human brain. So it's not the only tool that we have, and we have psychological studies, and we have evolutionary thinkers, and we have many different ways to look at this creative process. I think one of the dangers that we get into, and I'm a neuroscientist by training and practice, but one of the dangers we get into is reifying or putting on some sort of pedestal neuroscience as the only way that we can get to an understanding of how creativity is organized in the human brain. And I think by triangulating or looking at lots of different types of studies, whether it's studies from history, studies from psychology, studies from neuroscience, we can get a deeper and richer understanding of this extraordinarily complex human capacity. Even other animals, looking at dolphin creativity and rodent creativity, the creativity of corvids, I think is important. If this is truly, why would it exist only in humans, and does it exist across evolutionary time? I think this is really important to look at across different species, even. So I think just looking at it from a neurological perspective could leave us with tunnel vision if we don't open our perspective.
Can evolution say anything about, you know, how creativity emerged, or can those sorts of studies, deep historical sort of research, give us any idea as to how this emerged? I mean, presumably it was advantageous at some level.
I think it's important to realize that the pinnacle of ape and proto-human type of intellectual ability was the Acheulean hand axe, and this sharpened axe was around for over a million years, almost 1.5 million years, a very stable intellectual development to do cutting and to use as a weapon and perhaps hunting. This is a very stable intellectual development for a long period of time. But then in the last 50,000 years, with this brain that is very similar to the one that we have now, something important happened in evolutionary time. And different thinkers from evolutionary, psychological, neuroscience are trying to figure out what happened 50,000 years ago that led to this explosion of creative capacity, from the cave drawings to art to culture, to the written word that led to, you know, the iPhone and the internet that we enjoy today, modern culture. But this explosion of creative capacity is really quite dramatic in evolutionary time.
Anna, when you look across the sort of sciences, do you find any areas that look particularly promising in trying to crack essentially what creativity is?
Well, yeah, I mean, I see the neurosciences as one of the best ways to study it, really. Your question was whether it can be studied sensibly, and I think there's no reason to assume that creativity is something that cannot be studied using the brain sciences at all. I mean, it emanates from our brain. It's a brain capacity. Why shouldn't we be able to do it? The only thing that's very critical about creativity is that you can't study it in the way that other aspects of cognition are usually studied because of the nature of the process itself, because it can't be prompted. We can't be as creative as we want to be when we want to be. The ephemeral nature of the process makes it very difficult to study. So that is the challenge in studying creativity by neuroscientific techniques. It was not a very sort of well-researched topic for the longest time. Not many groups were studying creativity, but now increasingly now you see labs all over the world starting to engage themselves in this process. And we need that. I think what's lacking in the field of creativity and trying to understand how our brains are able to be creative is the fact that there's not enough of us working actually in the field. If you compare it to any other field of higher order cognition, whether it's language or memory, where you have thousands of labs the world over, creativity is quite unusual in that very few people are studying it. So it has to do with funding and all sorts of other things. But just as any other field of psychological function, it needs to be approached from multiple perspectives, including neuroscientific perspectives. But it won't be the only one that informs us about everything. Again, the question is what is important. To ask the question of, is there one area in the brain that gives rise to creative thinking? We are long past this point. We know that that's not really a kind of useful question to ask. We're certainly interested in understanding the creative brain as a whole. How are we able to navigate through environments? How do we come up with original solutions when our environments are constantly changing? We see creativity in daily life, in our daily actions. How does the predictive, you know, a brain that is built to be for these perceptive, predictive cycles, how does creativity come from this essentially predictive brain? It seems almost counterintuitive. We need as many approaches as we can to try and study that and to get at what that is and how we are as a species so uniquely creative. Not that other species aren't creative, they certainly are. But why did we go on to develop all of these amazing feats of art and science and artistry?
It's hard for me, at least, to think of how you would design an experiment to tease these things out. And I'm wondering, have you come across, any of you, come across any experiments that are starting to ask the right questions or at least applying the right kind of methodologies to this kind of question? I don't know what experiments you do that really seem, you know, sensible at getting at the heart of this.
I think there are plenty. Again, I think one of the problems is to see creativity as this singular, unitary sort of construct that one study would address everything about the construct. That's just not possible. There are multiple approaches. Rex uses different approaches than I do, but we're trying to get at quite similar things. We need to understand how the creative brain does what it does. My approach is to break it down into different processes of creativity, for instance. So I'd try to distinguish between the capacity for conceptual expansion and compare that to the differences in when we're trying to engage in creative imagery. Other people would, for instance, look at the association with creativity and intelligence. It's a huge topic. You can approach it from different angles, and different labs sort of have their own approaches to try and understand it. And I think collectively we can come to, hopefully in the near future, if not in the distant future, to real insights about how it is that humans are so creative.
Anna, when you talk about conceptual expansion, what do you mean by that?
Conceptual expansion is essentially, as the phrase suggests, the ability to widen the limitations of concepts that we have. So this is central to any sort of creativity. So creativity is essentially about producing original ideas. That means novelty. So that in itself means that you look at you develop a concept in a new manner. So we have concepts about everything, chairs, vegetables, what have you, social categories. Our ability to expand our concept means taking on new elements to be included in that concept that were not associated with that concept before. So conceptual expansion, the ability to broaden your conceptual structures lies at the absolute sort of crux of what creativity is. So I look at that in my own work to try and understand, okay, how is it, what happens in the brain when my concepts are being expanded in real time? What kind of structures are involved? What kind of brainwave patterns are being generated? Which patient groups, neurological or psychiatric, have disadvantages, advantages, or no differences at all? How does this compare when I compare that aspect of creativity to something like creative imagery or the ability to overcome examples, the constraining influence of examples when trying to be creative? So For instance, when you're trying to engage in conceptual expansion, and you're trying to generate something new, if I show you an example of how someone else did that, how someone else produced something new, it actually poses a huge restriction on your ability to do the same. Again, then, if we look at that aspect, we see a different range of brain structures and networks involved. So that's the kind of approach I take to try and say, well, it's just like if you would study memory. You don't say, what is memory as a whole, and give me, I want a one-line answer back. We understand that there are different forms of memory. We understand that the memory processes involved in learning how to swim are different from the memory processes involved when I'm thinking about my past birthday. We know that these are very, very different. They're both memory, of course, but they're both completely different forms of memory. And the same sorts of reasonings will have to be applied in the case of creativity, where we understand that what's generally understood by the term creativity is the same across domains, as Rex said before, but what differs, we must make distinctions between different aspects of creativity.
Rex, what do you think to you actually look like the most promising, the most fruitful approaches to try and get some traction on creativity?
Well, Anna's done a very good job of describing her approach, and she's not going to brag on herself, but I will. I think her approach is fundamentally one of the best and at the heart of the approaches that will move this field forward. I mean, this notion of conceptual expansion and constraint of example gets at the crux of the definition of creativity, which is novelty generation on one hand and the approach to something that is useful on the other. So this back and forth between novelty generation and then selection of the most useful thing to push forward is what she's exploring with this conceptual expansion and constraint of example. So her research is really getting at the heart of the definition of creativity and then doing it in such a way in a functional imaging environment that really allows us to understand the brain networks and the neural networks that are involved in these two very fundamental aspects that are central to the creative process. There will be additional components and subcomponents that are underneath these two very large novelty and usefulness mechanisms of creativity, but she's getting at the heart of these two very basic and fundamental capacities that underlie how creativity is manifested across domains and perhaps across species and across evolutionary time. I think it's very important work that she's doing.
Can you unpack for me this idea of constraint of example? I didn't quite understand what was meant by that.
I call it constraints of examples, but it's basically a task that cognitive psychologists of creativity came up with in the 90s, and they called it the recently activated knowledge task. And in that task, it was Stephen Smith, I think, who basically devised a toy task. So he asks his participants to invent a new toy that has never existed before and does not currently exist. And it's a pretty difficult task. And before they start on it, he gives them examples of supposedly novel tasks that were generated by other people. And these have been engineered by the experimenter to have three features in common. So they all involve the presence of a ball, for instance, all three of them. Each of them involve the presence of electronics, and each of them involve a high degree of physical activity. Of course, it's not consciously obvious to the person. They're just seeing these completely new tasks. And then you assess their own abilities to generate new toys. And if you compare groups who had these examples shown to them beforehand with those who didn't, the ones who were shown the examples beforehand tended to, in their own inventions of toys, have these three features, one or more of these features, than people who didn't see the examples. So that was, let's say, the first study that showed that examples, not just examples that are somehow very salient, impose a huge limitation in your ability to be creative, because you're trying to create something new. You're trying to do something new that doesn't happen, that didn't exist, and suddenly given an example of something new that was created by somebody else, it poses a limitation on your ability to create yourself. In the time constraints that we're speaking of, they're given a few minutes. Perhaps, of course, this effect is very much limited to those few minutes, and it wouldn't sort of be sustained over days and so on. That hasn't really been looked at yet. But that is what is meant by the constraints of salient examples. It's sort of like the anti-working memory task. So in working memory, you have to keep information in mind in order to reach your goals. Over here, it's almost like you have to inhibit salient information in order to reach your goals. So my own studies have shown that if you have sort of information processing biases, that render you to be very distractible. Like if you, so adolescents with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or basal ganglia patients, you're better on this task. You're better at overcoming the constraining influence of examples because the examples are not very constraining. You're very easily distractible. So salient information is quickly pushed out of your mind. Whereas if you have a sort of healthy brain, it becomes very difficult because the brain is so cued into using salient information in the surrounding in order to be very, very efficient. And when you're trying to be creative and you're trying to produce something new, efficiency sometimes is the last thing that you want. You want to be able to, you know, overcome these really sort of, let's say, the path of least resistance, the trained ways of looking at things, the old routine ways of looking at things. So examples can be very constraining in that respect.
Rex, this has echoes in my mind of some of the work you've done looking at patients who have brain damage or brain disorders.
Yeah, I think this really has, you know, getting back to the original conversation of mental illness and brain disorders, Anna has done some of this work as well, that it, and your other speaker talked about, you know, this one brain that we have, and you start to think about continuums of function and dysfunction, and Anna alluded to this earlier, that, you know, the world and our interaction with the world exists in a very predictable way a large percentage of the time, and there's not many novel decisions that we have to make a large percentage of the time. So doing things rapidly and accurately and having that constraints of examples to work with works most of the time. It's that relatively few situations where we encounter something that we have not seen before and have not dealt with, that we have to, you know, proverbially think out of the box and come up with a novel solution. And we have to do that with this same brain. It has to be both rapid and accurate and constrained in dealing with an environment that is relatively predictable but occasionally unpredictable. And how does that happen in the same brain? And it gets to psychopathology at the extremes, where there may be overshoots at the extreme, where you get rigid adherence to rule-based behavior on one extreme that may be something like obsessive-compulsive disorder or autism or some of the other things that we call psychopathology on one rule-based behavior on one extreme, and things like psychosis and schizophrenia and bipolar, which is definitely more about novelty generation on the other extreme. And I think that may be why you see some interesting overlaps between creativity and psychopathology, because at those extremes are some prototypical examples of either novelty generation or constraint of example usefulness. And there's something interesting to explore there, both in psychopathology and in neural organization that has to exist in that one human brain that we have.
You had some interesting work looking at what happens in creativity, and this may have been anecdotal, so you can fill me in on that, but you showed what can happen when some people have dementia that affects the prefrontal cortex, and you were talking about how it was actually seemed to be releasing a kind of inhibition, which sounded similar to something Anna was saying, that made these people apparently behave or have the ability to be more creative. Have I got that right?
Well, it's not my work. That's work by Bruce Miller at University of San Francisco. And he has anecdotal studies of patients with frontotemporal dementia. And he's reported on patients that have developed this particular brain disorder. And it's mostly the semantic version of frontotemporal dementia, which is a more temporal variant of frontotemporal dementia, which is a disorder that causes degeneration of frontal and temporal cortex, selective degeneration. And this appears to cause a disinhibiting type of behavior in clinic. I've seen these patients in clinic, but Dr. Miller has described some patients that have been stockbrokers and housewives and working in the world that have picked up creative endeavors in the presence of this disease, whether it's painting or piano playing, and it's interesting anecdotal behavior. More systematic studies of patients with Alzheimer's disease semantic variant of frontotemporal dementia and overt frontotemporal dementia have failed to support this as a generalized capacity that increased creativity or is present in across all patients with semantic or frontotemporal dementia, but it is an interesting capacity seen in certain select cases.
Anna, do you think there's anything that people can do to boost their creativity?
Well, I don't think it's a one-shot sort of solution that will work for all. I certainly think it's possible for everyone to be more creative than they are. And it's possible to enhance most of your cognitive skills, if not all of them. And creativity is no different from that. In terms of brain intervention techniques, such as TDCS, in improving creativity, I think that's just a few studies have started to come out now that have looked at this and have shown some degrees of improvements that are possible, even though we don't know how stable they are. It's certainly something that I'd like to look at in the future in terms of how it relates to brain plasticity is what I'm very interested in and how it can be sustained throughout one's life. So there are certain interesting studies that look at aging and how everything seems to all your cognitive capacities seem to deteriorate with aging, but creativity seems to be relatively immune to that. There's very few sort of studies that have looked at that, but I'm very interested in that sort of idea that why would creativity sort of not suffer as quickly as all of the other cognitive capacities? What allows that to be sustained? And so plasticity, not only in terms of understanding how children can be creative, or young adults or middle-aged adults can be more creative, but also whether we can use, let's say, the stability of creativity in aging populations to sort of see that as a sort of, let's say, a reverse intervention to try and help them with other capacities as well. I'm interested in boosting creativity, but not only for the sense of, oh, it would be great for all of us to be more creative. Of course it would, and of course it's possible. The question is only, what are the different methods that we can use? Are they specific to age groups? Are they specific to the type of creativity? Are they short-term or long-term? And the most exciting things would be to try and see if we can use, let's say, good capacities and creativity to get at stopping other aspects of cognitive functions from deteriorating quite as fast. So I see that as a hugely important and interesting field that's coming up. But again, very much in the nascent phase, there's so much to be done there. So I don't want to reach any easy conclusions about is it possible to boost creativity? I think it most certainly is, but I don't think that's saying too very much at all without going into the specifics of it.
What you're saying seems to touch on what might be another myth, which is that a lot of people will do their most creative work probably before they're 30. You certainly hear this in physics, you hear it sometimes in mathematics. And I wonder, you seem to be saying that actually creativity doesn't look as if it falls off with age.
I don't think so. Again, it's very specific. Those kinds of observations about creative potential and the maximal point of creative potential come from the mathematical field. And the question is, what is it about that age? Is it really the age? Is it the brain's capacity at that point? Is it the kind of sort of environmental factors that are there at that point? Is it pre-family, post-family, and so on? I think by always focusing on the highest and lowest points and things like that, I think we miss the big picture really, which is that even if you're not at the peak of whatever people consider a peak, it doesn't really mean that people aren't continuing to be creative. It's not like, you know, you're diving to the end of and being a totally useless person. It's not like that at all. Creative capacities and potentials are always there. We can't only be judged by the one most creative thing that we do. And by always sort of focusing on the best and the worst, I think we stand to lose a lot. And I don't think we do that for any other function, human cognitive function. I don't see why we do that for creativity. In my view, the most important thing in realizing your creative potential is to have the belief that you can do it more than anything else. Because, you know, you can try to boost people's creativity as much as you want them to externally, but if they don't want to do it themselves, it's not going to help more than in that particular moment. A lot of these ideas about there's this plateau coming, there's this peak, it's not that they're not untrue, but it doesn't mean that's the be-all and end-all. There's so much richness of life, there's so much that's there in terms of potential, regardless of whether you're at the peak or slightly below the peak. So too much focus on that, I think, detracts from the real important work that we need to be doing.
Caroline, you've been looking at ways of using brain stimulation to potentially boost creativity. Tell us a bit about that work.
Yes. So we've been working on a project to actually try to use brain simulation with low current, both TDCS and TACS.
So this is where you put electrodes on people's scalp, you run low current direct exactly. current through their brains.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you can actually try to target different areas or even different brain waves, if you like, with TACS or TDCS for different brain areas. And using that, we try to interfere with cognitive functioning. With creativity, we've been, like, the project I'm currently working in, we are trying to improve certain types of creativity, certain processes involved in creative thinking by using these techniques. So, but one important thing, I think that Anna in Rex, there was your talk, and I think it's very important to remember that creativity here, we have to break it down to smaller processes. So what we are actually trying is to interfere with tasks done in laboratory. And one of these tasks involves what we call the remote associate task. I can give you an example. For example, if I tell you three words, food, forward, and break, can you come up with a fourth word that makes a compound word or associates with these three words at the same time?
No.
I can give you a clue.
Can you, Rex?
No, I'm horrible at this task, though.
Me too. I just know it. I can give you a clue. It starts with F.
Okay. So food, forward,
and break.
Fast.
Yes, that's it. So we've been doing some also neuroimaging studies with this task. We have a collaborator in Vienna that we are running high-resolution 70 scans. So we are looking into what happens in the brain when you actually come up with the solution before the hint or after the hint when you actually use. So you're finding different brain areas to be associated with effective use of these hints, and also when people come up like on their own with the answer. But the basic idea is that there are different brain regions and also brain networks involved in either generating and self-generating these ideas, but also with using external information to integrate that into the response. So with brain stimulation, you can imagine that can be complicated, because when you're trying to influence a process that is complex and involves many networks of regions, different networks at least, it's very difficult to even target specific brain areas. And it's very unlikely that if you target a specific brain area, you're only going to be changing the activation of that certain area, because it's the brain is complex and it communicates. So you cannot really interfere with a single brain area as a module. So the idea we've been looking in is to interfere with one area, but actually look into more detail of how we solve those problems. So what we found so far is very consistent results in brain stimulation interfering with the problem of that sort that you are more likely to be stuck. Whereas other problems that are easier to solve, our protocol for brain stimulation doesn't seem to work very well.
So are you saying that this brain stimulation can make people better at this task?
It seems, but in specific items of the task. So
right.
What I'm bringing to the discussion is that even the laboratory tasks that are supposed to be more constrained and more controlled are actually very heterogeneous. And therefore, when you interfere with like a brain region, you actually get an outcome that is not exactly uniform, because it also depends on the sub-processes of solving the problem. And that's what we're trying to do, is to dissect these items and trying to understand which cognitive processes are involved in each of those, and then therefore like how we can interfere with them. But it seems a nice avenue for research.
This kind of stimulation, as far as I understand it, it allows the neurons to fire at a lower threshold than they would normally. Is that about right?
Yeah, there is a lot of controversy in right. terms of the cellular effects of low current brain stimulation, because actually you stimulate at a current that is enough for a neuron to fire, but you're more likely to interfere with the threshold, as you said, of the network of the neurons underneath the stimulated area. It is likely to be the case, and especially we don't know very well with TACS, because with TDCS,
So this is direct current, TACS meaning an alternating current.
Exactly.
Yeah.
With alternating current, you try to entrain a frequency for example, Alpha. And that's what we've been doing in this project, but we're also working with DCS, focusing on specific brain areas.
So how specific an area can you focus on, though? Because can you, I've always been interested in TDCS studies and the like, because you think, well, how well can you target a particular brain region, and how much can you say about the what your results mean? If you find a result, a significant result, which means you presumably have to test this on an awful lot of people to get that statistical significance. Mm-hmm. But what you can actually say about, okay, we know that you don't want to just say, oh, we know it's something in the frontal cortex. You need to say, be more specific, right?
Yeah, so one way is to combine brain stimulation with neuroimaging with fMRI, for instance, mm-hmm. And that has been done, including there's some published work showing that you can even target subcortical brain regions by exploiting the connections, the structural connectivity, and then test that further with fMRI, because otherwise you cannot really make any mm-hmm. point. However, in reality, what happens is like lots of brain stimulation studies do not have the resource of actually going for fMRI scan every time, or it isn't feasible, or for many other reasons. But there are a lot of limitations on up to what extent you can actually conclude about any other brain region. But you can, in practical terms, you can say, well, this protocol seems to be reliable to improve this sort of region, but that also has to be replicated. So it's always tricky.
Sure. Rex, what do you make of any techniques out there that people might use or might be on the horizon for people boosting their creativity? Or is it all going to come down to pharmaceuticals?
No, I think pharmaceuticals are way too general of an effect. As you know, with any pill that you take, it has both efficacy effects and it has side effects. And so And they're very generalized, and that's why most pharmaceuticals have side effects, is because it's working on your whole body, not just your brain. And we haven't had these targeted pharmaceuticals that allow us to, you know, really target discrete neural networks that we would like to target. So I think pharmaceuticals are largely off the table as far as that's concerned. That I see. I mean, there's talk about nano probes and putting things in through through that mechanism, but that appears to be outside of my lifespan. So I think that would be interesting, but off the table. Getting back to what Anna said, I think that everyone, creativity is a capacity that everyone can increase, just as you can increase your working memory, you can increase your attention. You can increase many cognitive capacities. So it is a cognitive capacity like anything else that your brain does that you can train and exercise different components to increase your capacity over time. And once we understand what the fundamental capacities are, whether it's insight, as we were discussing some of these remote associate tasks or tasks of insight and constraint or novelty generation, I think we will learn tools and tricks and techniques to increase those behaviorally. And I'm cautiously optimistic, I guess, about some of the more TACS than TDCS. We've done some of this research in the past of TDCS, and it is, like pharmaceuticals, it's a very broad brush approach to the brain. It as you suggest, kind of blasts the frontal lobe or parietal lobe, and is not very specific as applied currently. But TACS, I think, is more interesting.
So at the moment, it sounds like you're saying, yes, there will be ways of improving our creativity, but what those tools actually are is probably unknown right now.
I think so. And we've been down this road with intelligence and trying to improve intelligence with working memory training and with TDCS, and it didn't hold up well. So I think going down the same road with creativity is likely to yield the same unsatisfying results. This is something that requires long-term intervention in the brain, and to get lasting results in the brain, you have to do long-term interventions.
Rex, is it actually important for us to be creative? Does it drive a lot? Is it a valuable thing for us to have and perhaps boost?
Oh, certainly. I think we've seen in the last 40, 50,000 years, the technological advances we've been able to make as a species that has both benefits and costs. And And one of the costs is that the technological advances that we're making are leaving us more vulnerable to increasing instabilities. And so some of the challenges that we face as a species are becoming increasingly complex. And certainly we are going to have to be more creative moving into future generations in order to overcome some of these environmental challenges that are coming our way in the next few decades and centuries as we attempt to move forward as a species and as a planet.
And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Anna Abraham, Rex Jung, and Caroline de Bernardi-Luft. Science Weekly will be taking a summer break throughout August. You can catch up on any editions you've missed on the Guardian Science page. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening and see you again in September.
When you want the whole picture, you choose The Guardian. When you want to create your own, you choose Squarespace, the all-in-one website building platform that lets you buy domains, create your own logo, and more. Whatever you want to showcase, Squarespace gives you simple yet powerful tools and elegant designs to make any idea brilliant. Create your own picture at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.